Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Richard Florida. Richard is a professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. He's also a distinguished fellow at the New York University's Schack Institute. He's editor-at-large and co-founder of CityLab. And as many listeners will know, he's a prolific writer and author, including his seminal books, The Rise of the Creative Class and The New Urban Crisis. Richard, welcome to City Talks.
Andrew, thanks so much for having me.
So we're going to be talking about COVID-19 and the effect of the virus and the pandemic on cities now, both now, but also I think how you think it'll affect them in the future. So I should say we're recording this on the 14th of April 2020, when both our countries are still very much in the depths of the pandemic. And we're not quite sure yet whether we've met the we've got anywhere near the peak. So I think that's a bit of context for people that are going to be listening. But Richard, I want to start get you to come straight in with your views on issues in relation to density. You know, when we look at many commentators have gone squarely in on this kind of density issue and really much very much blamed cities for the spread of the virus for it. Obviously, we know cities have always played a historically important role in both in terms of spreading viruses, but also tackling them as well. But what's your view on the current debate around density? Is it accurate when we look at the data?
Well, it's certainly a big question, and there's certainly a wide range of opinions, and both city boosters and even, I think, more so city dammers have come out on each side. You know, you said this, Andrew. I think that density or the clustering of people in cities has always led to advances in science, advances in arts and culture. And really, we know now that it's the key factor that propels economic growth, the clustering of people and ideas and knowledge and economic assets and universities and knowledge institutions in cities is what's kind of the main propellant of innovation and economic growth. At the same time, that clustering of people and density also accelerates the spread of infectious disease. Now, that's been like that since time immemorial. And, you know, I've spent my time in quarantine, if you will, or quasi-quarantine or lockdown, reading up on the history of pandemics. You know, that's the way I've tried to. And it's interesting because as an urbanist, I've never really thought twice about pandemics or infectious disease, really. I mean, I never thought twice about the 1918 Spanish flu. I never thought twice. I had read a book or two on the London cholera epidemic. I'd never thought much about the plagues. I thought about cities growing, cities like London or New York or San Francisco. I'd not even seen a blip, really, to be honest with you. I'd not seen that these bouts of infectious disease or plagues, viral plagues, had made a blip in the process of urbanization. Moreover, I mean, for folks listening in, I was born in 1957. In the middle of a pretty major pandemic, probably not quite as big as this one, and certainly not as big as 1918, but it killed like 100,000 Americans and millions of people across the world. My parents never told me. So I had no idea. I personally was born in the middle of an influenza pandemic. If you look back through all of human history, the force of urbanization, of the clustering of people in cities, has always outweighed the negative cost or diseconomy of infectious disease. And that was before, you know, you think about London, the cholera epidemic, or you think about, you know, the United Kingdom in the Spanish influenza. That's before we had modern medicine. That's when workers were mobilizing for a war effort and they were packed in factories and tenements. I've read the histories of Pittsburgh, where I lived for nearly 20 years. Most workers didn't have any health coverage. They didn't have hospitals. Rich people had hospitals accessible. We didn't have antibiotics that could fight secondary infection. We didn't have antiviral treatments. We didn't have ready oxygen masks. Now we have all of those things. So my hunch is that we will come out of this okay. And that our great cities, London and New York and Paris and Berlin and Toronto, will survive and thrive again. As to the specific question of density, I've looked at this very closely, as have others. Other, you know, it's been very interesting to watch urban economists and urbanists come and really start to do research on this. Not only has the scientific community mobilized, but the urbanist and urban economist community mobilized. The best evidence we have is that density is a factor. Obviously, the pandemic struck hard at dense places like New York, like London, like Paris, like Madrid. But I also should say it didn't just strike hard at those places. It struck hard at industrial supply chain cities like Wuhan. Think about Detroit, which was hit in many ways harder than on a per capita power population basis. Or Northern Italy, which is connected also to China through industrial supply chains, one of the great industrial regions of the world. And of course, we know it also spread, especially in Europe, through these great ski destinations in the Alps and in America through the Rockies. So density is one factor. And in statistical models, it's positive and significant, probably driven by the fact that it hit a place like New York. But other factors matter, and I think they're worth talking about. Density, it's not all, that all density matters the same. I call it the difference between rich people density and rich place density and poor place density. You know, rich people or professional and managerial workers, knowledge workers, have the great good fortune of being able to work remotely like we're actually doing now. We're both working remotely and folks listening in are probably doing so. I was saying to you, I can get most things delivered to my apartment quickly. We have very good delivery services in the United States for grocery, for pharmacy, for goods that we need. I haven't had to go to a store. We don't have to take transit. You know, I think that but the frontline workers, one in three Americans, probably a similar figure for people in the United Kingdom, frontline workers in delivery, warehouse work, transit work, medical work, you know, they come in contact with the virus where they work and how they get to work. And one commentator called it not density per se, exposure density. I quite like this term. We can have density in isolation. Others have density in exposure. And then that way the virus hits hard. The other factors that matter is the age structure of the population. I mean, places that have older people get hit harder, like Northern Italy. You know, some critics of urbanism have bemoaned childless cities. But if you look at San Francisco, people say San Francisco locked down early, it's done well. San Francisco is the most childless city in the United States, has the lowest percentage of children in the home, and children act as vectors. Gentrification. Most people bemoan gentrification, including me. I wrote a whole book called The New Urban Crisis. More gentrified places with more affluent people, with more remote workers and less frontline workers get hit less. Higher, more affluent places, places with higher incomes, places that are fitter, places with higher incomes usually have fitter populations, less obesity, less pre-existing conditions. And then on the flip side, people have talked about how social and civic capital make places more robust. And I think both of us agree that they do. The place that has usually been cited as the place that has the most social capital and was a benchmark for Robert Putnam's great book, Bowling Alone, is Northern Italy. And as one person on Twitter said, the great tragedy of this, we'll find that social capital actually accelerated flow of the virus. It's not to say social capital is bad, like it's not to say density is bad. But if you have large numbers of multi-generational families, lots of people who like to get together with family and friends, a good thing. You have high degrees of religiosity and religious ties in churches and temples. All the things that people like to see in a great community, those things propagate the virus. So I think there are many facets of cities in addition to density that make the virus spread more or less easily.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree. And in a sense, you know, looking at the data in the UK, the simple relationship between density and cases and or deaths is, but as you say, is not straightforward. You have to factor in a whole bunch of other issues, both at the personal and at the community level, in order to make some sense of that for certain. So you talked about sort of different places that are affected by it to a greater degree or not. What's your sense, Richard, as to how places are responding now, particularly in the US, how the cities are responding, I suppose, you know, given what they are and their position within the governance structure in the US. And then maybe we'll touch on your thoughts about the role of the federal government and whether they're doing maybe what they should and could be could be doing. But, you know, have you got a sense as to how different places are responding and how we might make sense of that before, rather than just go round and round, you know, go to each one case by case?
My sense is in the U.S., the local and state response has been very good. You know, we have a system here that we refer to as federalism or federalistic, a distribution of power between local governments, state governments, and the national government. Over the course of the past century, we have pushed power, and I think because of the rise of industrialism and giant firms and mass worker movements and world wars, the need to provide a social safety net, to mobilize a military budget, we've pushed power up the chain. And in many of us, not just me, believe that the federal government and what they call the imperial presidency has too much power. I think in the United States now, you can see a case that not only is the federal government dysfunctional and polarized, that with Donald Trump at the helm, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you have someone who's not up to the task. The administration or regime has handled this horrifically at best, including muting our healthcare agencies like the CDC. And it's been up to local governments and state governments to carry the ball. And what's interesting, you know, not to make a value judgment, but I think the blue states, particularly California and New York, now Detroit, Michigan is also blue, Washington is also blue, have done a pretty good, darn good job. And not just in locking down. I think the easy answer is they locked down early. Many states locked down at about the same time. And as I said, there are other factors which cause the virus to spread in addition to lockdown. I think it's just that San Francisco locked down early. I just think San Francisco is a richer, more educated, more gentrified, younger, more childless place that helped it. And New York is a bigger, more diverse, you know, has more poverty concentrations, older people, more pre-existing conditions. And certainly Detroit suffers from all of that. So I think the states and localities have carried the ball. Now we're seeing in the United States that these East and West Coast states have actually created a consortia. New York and Massachusetts and several others on the East Coast, I believe Connecticut and New Jersey, and then California and Washington and several others on the West have created a consortia to share supplies, to share medical knowledge, to help mobilize. What a wonderful thing. And I think the federal government has been incompetent. Now, I want to also say that, you know, my great friend, the late Ben Barber, wrote a book that I'm very fond of called If Mayors Rule the World. And I've come to a slightly different take on that. And I think Ben did too. You know, you have Boris Johnson as your prime minister, a former mayor of London. And I think people would argue that he didn't handle, and how fortunately he survived his own personal bout with the virus, he didn't handle it well either. So it's not like you can just put a mayor in the office of national head of state and do well. I think that the national office actually is not structured to do well. That the local and state levels, the more local levels, have their hands on the pulse. They're more pragmatic. They're better able to deal with disaster recovery and relief. They're better to deal with recovery of their local economies. So I think that it's the local and state level that have to be. And you know, you've had this experiment in your country with metropolitan governance, metropolitan mayors. I would hope that out of this, one of the things we begin to think about more is how to devolve power from this kind of federal national level that doesn't work very well to the state and local level, which works better. But, you know, I do know that the history of pandemics and the history of fear and insecurity has tended to be to empower the national level. You know, people get scared and they get frightened, and it's tended to be biased towards authoritarians. Now, I don't think that's the case today. I don't think Donald Trump will win in November. I think that Biden's likely to win. I think we're likely to move away from authoritarianism in the West. I think we're likely to be better. But that said, in the past, that's tended to be the process. And my hope is that a silver lining might be that because of the dysfunction at the national level, we are able to empower our states and localities to deal better, not only with pandemics and health problems, but to deal better with economic and other challenges they experience.
And do you have a sense as to, you know, you were saying some places have, you know, have gone further and went faster and done more. Some had beneficial, you know, fundamentals in place in order to do that. Richard, you talked a little bit there about, you know, the politics, the blue states being maybe more interventionist earlier than some of the red states. But I mean, can you characterize the sorts of responses, and in a sense, whether how important the pre-existing fundamentals were. I was talking to sort of around resilience in the last city talk. So, you know, and Lena was making this point that actually, if in order to respond and prepare for things like pandemics, it's what you've done before the pandemic hits is much more important than what you're actually able to do, you know, when the pandemic arrives. And I just wonder whether, you know, you have a sense as to how that plays out in this, you know, in the States.
Well, in the States, every place was unprepared and no place believed this would hit. And, you know, even though we like to blame Trump, and, you know, I'm the first one to try to do that, the Democrats in Congress knew, the Democrats in the Senate knew, the people in the CDC knew, governors of big states knew, I kind of knew, epidemiologists knew, yet we're always just going to blame Trump for not responding. Lots of other people kind of had a sense what was happening, and I think we didn't want to believe it. I'd also say that this is quite common in the United States. You know, my dad, who was born in 1921, who then, after Pearl Harbor was attacked, joined the U.S. military as an infantry soldier, was deployed to London, to the U.K., and then stormed the beaches at Normandy. He always said that when he enlisted, I remember him saying this, a guy with a seventh grade education factor, when he enlisted in the Army, the U.S. was terribly unprepared. He got a doughboy hat from World War I and World War I surplus uniform and a broomstick to train with. But the mobilization happened very quickly. And I think it's exactly the same thing. Now, the places that mobilized much better were places like Hong Kong and places in Asia that had been hit by the SARS epidemic. So if you had a memory of the SARS epidemic or other epidemics, you seem, you know, I was talking to friends in Hong Kong and said immediately when they first heard of this, people, they saw queues. These were Brits, right, who were expats. They literally saw queues at the drugstore and people putting the masks on and buying supplies. They were like, what's going on? So they were ready to gear up. In the US, I think we've had three kinds of responses. The first kind of response is this immediate mobilization. And I think Governor Cuomo, now think about this. This is a state that has been flattened, has more deaths now in New York probably than most countries. So obviously they didn't lock down at the right time. They were hit hard. And we don't know. This thing seems to have been floating around New York. There's a recent study that looked at pregnant women who went to labor and delivery clinics. They found that 1 in 8 of these women who went to labor and delivery in mid-March to early April had no symptoms, had COVID. They tested them all, had COVID-19. And only 3 of the women ever developed a fever. So 1 in 8, now this is a small sample, but you know, I think this thing has been floating around and a lot of people caught it, especially in big dense cities where people travel a lot and come and go. I think, but the mobilization has been one thing. And I think that New York's done a heck of a good job there. Governor Cuomo's done a good job. I think California under Governor Newsom did a really good job of locking down early. Now it may not be lockdown. You know, people talk about the difference between the United States and Sweden. I have great friends and collaborators in Sweden. They don't have a lockdown. But what my friends in Sweden say is that people believe experts. There's a high degree of educational attainment. People listen and they do it. You don't need a government stricture in Sweden. She says her daily life is about the same as mine, but they don't have a formal lockdown in place. So I'm not sure how much a physical lockdown matters. You know, I'm spending the winter in Florida. I've been on sabbatical. I was trying to work on a television docuseries on cities that went up in it. Now I'm working on the COVID crisis. We didn't really have a lockdown, but where I am, people locked down. I mean, no, you go for a walk and you see some people walking in the, you know, when biking in a bike lane. You didn't see anybody out and about. And so, yes, that mattered. I think what's going to really matter now is the response to the, if you think about disaster relief and recovery, there's immediate mobilization, financial assistance and medical assistance, getting people out of danger, harm's way, rescue and recovery. Then there is reopening. You've got to get stuff prepared to reopen. And then there's recovery. And that's where I think the resiliency will really come in. It would have been better if we were more prepared, but I think now we have time to repair. You know, who knows how long we'll be in this lockdown. Let's say it's 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. We now have time to think about, and what worries me is I see very few cities actually doing that mental exercise. They're throwing everything into immediate mobilization, protect small business. You know what I'm saying. Try to deal with the fallout for arts and culture, get workers relief, get the medical surge capacity. But no one's thinking like, 2, 6, 10, 18 months out, how do we reopen effectively? And then how do we recover? And I think that's going to be the next phase, and that's going to make a really big difference.
And you've been thinking and already beginning to sketch out your thoughts in terms of that sort of post immediacy reopening and then the recovery. So just give us a sense as to where your thinking is in terms of reopening and recovery, and then we'll go on to, because I'm really keen to get your thoughts on this kind of the bigger questions, I suppose, of the future of cities. You alluded to at the beginning that you're an optimist, but I'm curious as to whether you think that some behaviours will change. Some people or some firms will make different locational decisions given the experience than they may have historically, and we can get into some of those kind of questions. But just paint us a picture for reopening and recovery. What would you want or expect or like to see our cities doing?
Well, I'm not a tactical expert. I'm a big broad thinker about urbanism, a professor, and it's been really interesting to see my own mental model shift towards tactics. And I didn't even know I had this capability. So it's kind of been good for me, and maybe it's been therapeutic for me. Maybe it's hard to think big thoughts in a time of crisis. Maybe we all just move to tactics, like trying to make sure your family's safe. So what I began to think about is, people said, we're going to reopen. Well, we're not just going to press a button and things are going to pop back to the way they were. And I think that a lot of other people, really brilliant people like my colleague Paul Romer and others, Scott Gottlieb at the American Enterprise Institute, Zeke Emanuel, the doctor, have been saying, we need to test and trace. We need more testing. We need to have testing for the virus, and we need to have testing for the antibodies. We need to know if you even talk about these immune certificates, kind of crazy idea. If you had it, are you safe to go back to work because you had it and you have some antibodies? Or if you get it, now we have this, not only did we see this in China and in Singapore and in Korea, where they tested people and then they traced all their contact tracing. We're now seeing Apple and Google have this partnership where they're saying, if you get COVID, you'll tell your phone, I had COVID. And your phone, using the signals to other phones, will then alert everyone you've been near, to say you've been near a person who had COVID-19. If you don't have antibodies, go isolate yourself for 14 days. But I think there's more to it than that. I don't think that's enough. I think that in order to get our cities back up and running, they're going to have to be perceived as safe and secure. So I developed with my colleague, Stephen Pedigo, who is much more a tactician than I am, a 10-point plan, a preparedness plan, and can share it with folks. We have a slide deck on this and articles. But basically, we're going to need to retrofit our airport. So think about London Heathrow. Think about John F. Kennedy Airport, Toronto Pearson Airport. What was done in the wake of the 9/11 tragic terrorist attacks with greater security, and you put your stuff in a plastic bag and, I remember going through Heathrow and my wife had this kind of piece of jewelry that was sticking out. And the guy said, is that brass knuckles? And she's like, no, it's a ring, and she put it in her bag and she was fine. The kind of retrofitted airports, in China, you see them doing the temperature screenings when you go in. You could see you're kind of not line up in a big queue. You're going to have design for social distancing. You're not going to wait at the baggage claim. You're going to have to fix that. You're going to board the plane individually. Maybe there'll be a middle seat empty. You're not going to queue up in the waiting room. You're going to have spacing. And the same thing with arenas, in stadiums. How are people going to go back and feel safe? Well, think about this one, transit. They say even in China now, people are very, very scared and they're using cars much more. What will it take? Because we know the virus spread in New York on the transit line. What's it going to take to make people feel safe on transit? How about small business? Big companies, an airline company, a transit agency, an arena might actually have Disney with a Disney park, have expertise in, and they actually have medical professionals and disease specialists who can help them prepare. What about small business? I think about, when am I going to feel safe going back to get my hair cut? When's my wife going to go to the nail salon? Or when will we go visit a small retail shop? I think they're going to need advice. And one place I've turned is doctors. I've talked to my friends who are dentists and orthodontists and pediatricians and dermatologists. What they're doing, to make sure there's not going to be anyone in the waiting room. Everyone's going to wear personal protective equipment. Not going to be multiple patients at once. There's not going to be people walking in and out. I think you can begin to think about what it would take the arts and cultural economy. You know, we're not going to go back to big conferences, Glastonbury, Lollapalooza, Coachella, Taylor Swift, the Rolling Stones, U2. But, you know, here's one for local cities. Maybe this is a time we can support local arts and culture. And I've been talking to a lot of foundations about this, especially in small towns in the States. What if you set up a local portal for artists, musicians, chefs, entertainers, performers, and your city can do this? And it's not just an events calendar. What if you take your events calendar and make it a portal to hire local people? And you're going to want to go outside. You're going to want to get together with friends. Maybe you feel comfortable with 10, 15, 20, 30 trusted friends and family. You know you've quarantined. You know you don't have it. You feel safe interacting after some period. You want to have a block party. You do it outside. You do it in a local park. Well, you hire a local musician, a local DJ, a local artist, a local chef. Or you want to do it outside at or inside at a venue that's safe. So you rent a venue that otherwise people wouldn't go to. I think there's a way that cities can start to think about this. The last one I would say is, I think we're all going to be wearing personal protective equipment for a while. I mean, you already see a lot of people in masks. What an opportunity to do something with the fashion and garment and clothing industry. I think that, you know, I think about taking my girls to the park. I have a 2 and 4 year old girl, taking them to the park and going on the swings. And of course, the swings need to be cleaned down eventually. And probably I'm going to want them to wear a mask and gloves. I can only imagine trying to put a surgical mask and rubber gloves. They'd freak out. But if, you know, they love Elsa and Anna, the Disney princesses. Imagine if they had little Elsa gloves and a little Elsa mask and a little Elsa cape. They love going to the dressed as princesses. So, you know, we've done a lot with fashion. You could actually make personal protective equipment that doesn't look either like, you know, a bandit scarf, you know, and you see people in, it actually scares me sometimes, or a hazmat suit. You know, my little one had to go to the pediatrician. She had a little cough. My wife wanted to be careful. And she said the pediatrician had a hazmat suit on. You could imagine as we come out of this, personal protective equipment being quite unobtrusive and quite stylish. So for example, when you go to a nice hotel in London or you go on a plane, British Air, the flight attendant or the hotel person has a really nice uniform, and some of them get a fashion designer, you know, to design it. What if you thought about PPE that way? What if you said, we're going to need this damn stuff? I talked to a friend of mine who founded a cosmetics company. I asked him what he would do. He said, well, I'd put a little visor that the person at the counter could put up or down, that kind of cute little tiara visor. All of this sounds silly, but in order to get up and running and our cities to go back to normal and people to not be scared, we're going to have to be protected. And we're going to have some health screens. We're going to have some personal protective equipment. We're going to have some social distancing. Let's do it in a way that makes people feel the most comfortable. And the time to prepare is now. Like, if we do this now, yeah, I know it makes sense. Doctors and economic experts have to mobilize. But there's a lot of people like us who are urbanists, urban planners, city. And then, of course, the open spaces. How do we retrofit our open spaces and streets to make them work? That's stuff we can and should be doing now.
Do you worry or do you think about then, I suppose, the sort of strategic implications? Because, you know, for airlines or venues or stadiums, and essentially you know, depending on which way you think about it, you're, you know, reducing the use of that space by 30% or 50%. And that's a cost, you know, it's a huge cost for whatever it is, that facility or that firm to bear. How do you think that will play out then in a kind of urban context, particularly, I suppose, in some of our cities where, you know, they are the most expensive bits of real estate and land in the country already? Do you think that has bigger implications for the types of activities that ultimately choose to either stay, reopen, or actually, you know, not reopen in somewhere, but actually go to somewhere else?
So what really worries me about this is that it will be accentuate the horrible class divides that we've seen in the economy and in our geography, but now heighten them in consumption. And I was talking to a really brilliant urban economist the other day, and he was saying, well, yeah, people are just going to pay more for first class or business class experiences, or we're going to have Lexus lanes. And for example, this American Thanksgiving, my girls wanted to see Frozen 2. They mentioned that they love this Disney movie. And my wife and I, there was no threat of COVID, but our family, her family is in Detroit. We just rented a little theater. It wasn't very much money. not a few $100. It wasn't thousands of dollars. It was a few $100. And we invited all their cousins and second cousins. So we had 30 to 50 kids there. You're going to see more of this. You're going to see people with means saying, I want to see a movie. I'll rent a theater. I want, and going to a ball game or a football game. You know, maybe it'll be a while till they open, but or a tennis match, Wimbledon. But you can't have everybody in there. So the ticket price is going to go way up. Personalized performances. You know, I mentioned maybe people will start to say, okay, I have money. I'll hire the Rolling Stones. Or there'll be a Rolling Stones concert in an outdoor venue with only a couple thousand people. And you'll pay, or you too, you'll pay a lot of money. Maybe in stores, there'll be Lexus lanes. You see this in some of the theme parks already. You pay more to go faster to go into the theme park. So airports and airlines, maybe it'll be fewer seats, more business class like seats, fewer people, you pay more. That could really accentuate inequality. Now, and I think in the way it will reshape our cities, you know, you see two visions. One, you see the dystopia. And the dystopia is you're going to walk out your apartment or flat in London or New York or Paris, and you're going to go down the street and all the arts and cultural venues will be closed. The museums will be shuttered. The theaters will be bankrupt. Broadway, you know, in the London Theater District won't exist. All the plays will have gone out of business. There'll be no music venues. The retail shops will be all closed. All that will be left is big boxes. And then there's the utopian vision that urbanists say, all the streets will be pedestrianized. The parks will be flourishing. We'll have bike lanes connecting everyone. And, you know, I don't think either of those will be what happens. And it won't really be in the middle. We'll go back to life, some semblance of what we had, but different and stranger. More people will be wearing masks. We will have to socially distance. They say in 1918, it took 4 or 5 years before people really got comfortable in large venues. Some sporting events may come back with no live crowds. You may have this weird thing where American baseball, you know, which is played outside, they all play in one city. I don't know if this is true, but and they go all day because there's nothing else on TV. You might have weird things like that. But I think our cities will come back. And I think one of the things that's interesting is because this might make space a lot cheaper. I think a couple things go out the window with this. I think the rich foreign buyers go away. It's like if these rich people who invaded London and New York and the pied-à-terre people, they're going to go back to big houses. They've already gone back to big houses. They're going to be scared. I think you're going to get office space is going to be harder to fill up. Co-working spaces are going to have a hard time. Retail stores will go bankrupt, a lot of them. So space in cities will become cheaper. And, you know, who are the most risk oblivious people in the world? Artists. You know, they will go into a war zone. And, you know, artists and musicians are the ones, they were called urban pioneers for a reason. When cities were unsafe and gritty and dangerous, they went to cities. So I think what might happen is you might have a reset where you could, I'm not saying will, because this could have happened after the financial crisis and didn't, where you could have a moment, and I don't think it will be long, where space becomes cheap enough that you could reignite local creativity and local culture, but it would be grittier. You know, it wouldn't be as polished and as posh. And it could be a little edgier, you know, that's my upside. But I think we can't it depends on how long this plays out. If it's 3 to 6 months, I think things will revert pretty much to the way they were. If it's 18 months to 2 years, I think we'll start to see some bigger changes.
And so in some regards, because you talk about this in your latest book, the New Urban Crisis, in a sense that, you know, we don't have to go back very far. I mean, certainly once we get into the 70s and 80s, where, you know, then we would have been talking about urban abandonment of even places like New York and London were not, you know, the places that they were by the late 1990s or the 2000s. You know, people were actively leaving, or at least they weren't coming. And it was very much in the 80s that this process of slow coming in from artists, creative industries, which are the kind of things that you were picking up in your first books around the creative class. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, there's a possibility that some of that may come back in some of our more resilient or superstar cities, as you've kind of called them or referred to them.
So I think there's a couple things that might happen. The one that I'm fairly confident will happen is that London, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Paris, Toronto, Hong Kong, Singapore, Shanghai, the big superstar cities and others like them, will see their positions strengthened. And this almost happens without regard to disaster or economic catastrophe, that in periods of stress, the already dominant cities get more dominant. And I think there are two reasons why that is even more likely today. The first reason is the industries that are concentrated in those cities, finance, arts and culture, media, entertainment, and high technology, require proximity and clustering. And it's not just they need face-to-face meeting. Matt Ridley said it's where ideas come to mate. If you're a young person and you want to make it in that industry, you have to build a personal network. You know, when I talk to people in tech or finance, they'll tell me that every job they got was a personal connection. You can't poke in remotely from Miami, or you know what I'm saying, or some Nashville or Asheville, or and do that kind of work. Maybe if you're very established, I remember I talked to Peter Jackson some years ago, the great director, and he said, yeah, he could move to New Zealand after he made a dozen successful films and establish his own little island of filmmaking. But he said he had to be in LA early in his career. You know, you're not going to produce London plays or New York plays or build high technology without being in San Francisco or London or New York. The second thing that's likely to reinforce the position of these places is restricted air travel. If air travel is restricted for a year or two, which it, and even if it comes back a little, but it's higher cost and people like me are scared to get on a plane, that means it's going to be very hard for hedge fund types to be down in Miami enjoying sun and fun and low taxes and then zoom back to New York on a weekly or every other week basis. Worse, it's going to be impossible for venture capitalists to monitor investments in remote locations. They're going to say what they've always have until recently. If you want to do a startup, come locate, you know, on my street, in my cluster. So restrictions on air travel are likely to massively increase the clout of superstar cities, magnifying the geographic inequality that your shop and my shop and Brookings have talked about. With regard to what happens within cities and metro regions, I think the story is different. And the way I think about it, and for folks listening in, I'm writing a feature for The Atlantic magazine. A big feature, 5,000 words or more on this now, so I'm thinking about it. I think there are going to be two classes of factors that work on city regions. One is a set of pull factors, and the other is a set of push factors. And it's hard to say what the balancing will be, and it depends on, again, how long this damn thing goes on. If it goes over shortly, there'll be fewer. If it goes on long, the push and pull factors will matter more. The pull factors. People are going to be terrified of transit and trains. There is no doubt about this, as much as I hate to say it. And unless we retrofit them and make them safe, people are going to get in their cars. That means for a place like London or New York or Toronto, traffic's going to increase massively. So we've got to think about this. People with families and older people are going to move out. And older people are going to move out because they're going to be scared. To the sub, not out of the but to suburbs or rural areas. We've already seen this in New York with people going to summer homes, vacation homes, bunking with family and friends. To be quite candid, almost everyone I know who lives in New York left the city. Almost every single person I know is not in New York City as we speak. That tells me something. If you have kids, because public amenities were closed, parks were closed, your building amenities were closed, you're going to say, maybe I want a yard and a swing set. And if you live in a nice climate, maybe a pool. And maybe this benefits places like Los Angeles. You know, maybe at the margin in New York, in the United States, people go, you know, I'm not going to go to some backwoods place. Not that there's anything wrong. But I might move from New York to Los Angeles. Not only I might move from New York to the Hudson Valley, I might go to Los Angeles. It's a big city. It has amenities. It's already as congested as it can be. It can't get any more congested because everyone drives a car. I'll go there. I think there'll be a preference for private amenity over public amenity. But the push factors, if I'm a young person and I want to establish a career, I'm going to the city. I feel like I'm immune to the virus. It doesn't really affect me. And the opportunities are there. Housing's a little bit cheaper. I think housing close to great industrial clusters like the London Finance Center, the New York Financial Center, the San Francisco Tech Districts, I think those areas that are bikeable and walkable will skyrocket in value because people will go, I'll pay a premium to be close to where I work so I have to avoid transit. I think that some of the great places in the UK and the United States that many urbanists love, these close-in suburbs with little cute downtowns and main streets that are on train routes, they're going to see their prices suffer. I think people are going to go, well, I was paying for the train. I don't have to pay for the train anymore. I'm going to drive anyway. But I think there will be push and pull factors. It's hard to say exactly how they will play out. I think we're going to see some. And here's one for you. If you look back at 1918 pandemic in the United States, a couple of facts. New York starts in 1910. If you go 1910 to 1930, it's the largest city in the United States in 1910 with about 4.8 million people. It's by far the largest city in the United States in 1930 with 6.9 million people. It grows larger. Chicago remains number two. And Philadelphia, even though Philadelphia was terrifyingly hit by that pandemic, stays number three. The big gainers in the 1918 pandemic were Detroit and Los Angeles. Los Angeles was not in the top 10 U.S. cities in 1910. It was the fifth largest city in 1930. But the other thing that happens, more in the United States than in the United Kingdom or Europe, is we see the first wave of real suburbanization. Now, if you're a fear of density person, you're like, well, that was, of course, people were afraid of cities and they migrated to the suburbs. But, you know, realize that in the 1920s, we introduced this powerful new technology called the automobile that enabled suburbanization. So it's not quite sure if it was fear of density and fear of disease. It may have simply been the car. But I do think we're going to get some suburbanization. I do think we're going to get some rural gentrification. But I think it's certain populations. It's those with families and kids, older and more vulnerable people. And again, this might create some opportunities for cities to reset. Younger, more ambitious people, more affordability, more ability to attract the artistic creatives and the risk oblivious. So we'll see that. I think the other thing that happens to cities is that they become much more segmented and unequal. And the differences between areas of advantage, rich people density, density plus isolation, and the areas of disadvantage where people exposed to the disease have to take longer transit commutes, I think that the differences between the professionals and the knowledge workers, the service workers and frontline workers, the advantage and the disadvantage magnify. And the question is, does that lead to some new movements? You know, in the 1920s, now look, you in England, we know this here, they called them the Roaring Twenties. It was not the period of kind of civic coming together and social benefit, but the union movements really gained steam. And there was the beginnings of real organizing in the Labor Party and the union movement and socialism in the United States that set the stage for the later, you know, surge in activity in the 1930s and 1940s and ultimately the social compact. So I don't think we're going to see this great movement to social betterment right away, but maybe the underpinnings of a new class consciousness and class awareness and the beginnings of those struggles for betterment of underpaid workers, service workers, who are as much as 50% of our workforce, up, you know, improving the lives of the disadvantaged, maybe we'll start to see that.
Because, yeah, I mean, that's the great point. That comes on to something I wanted to get your thoughts on. I wonder whether you see coming out of the, you know, what we've gone through, particularly, I'm sure it's the same in the US, but certainly in the UK, has been a very, very, very strong increase in the kind of valuation, I suppose, and the value given to frontline health workers or delivery, you know, drivers, you know, crudely public service professionals. But also, I mean, I suppose, you know, part of the economy, which is sometimes referred to as the everyday economy or the foundational economy. And, you know, historically in kind of urban economics, we've tended to focus a little bit less on those bits of the economy, particularly when we're thinking about innovation, entrepreneurship, wealth creation. I wonder whether you think there's going to be a sort of recalibration in the way that we kind of value different activities. And then how does that play out for cities and, you know, whether they're providing housing or, you know, offers for these kind of places, not for these kind of people, not just for, you know, the very top of the of the economy. What's your thoughts on that?
I do see this shift, and I've seen it for a while. You know, I said if I was going to write another book, it would be, you know, I wrote about the rise of the creative class. That's about a third of the workforce. Now, the working class is about a fifth, and then the service class is the great class. The frontline service workers, exactly what we're talking about, almost half the workforce. And I said if I was going to write another book, it would be on the class structure of modern capitalism, but particularly the service class. I could see this emerging before the crisis. I could see it among city officials, mayors, companies, saying we can't survive in a city where the frontline workers are priced out. Now I think it's changed the narrative. It's not just an issue of price and efficiency and competitiveness. Now people are saying human beings' lives are on the line. These are our true heroes. These are the people who kept us safe and secure. These are people who make the city run. And I had always hoped, going back to that book, Rise of the Creative Class, I said, at the end of that book, I said, I hope the creative class would grow up. Remember this, and this was in 2000. And understand that it's not just about making a cool gentrified house filled with cool furniture in a cool neighborhood. It was about growing a society, and I said, building a cross-class coalition with the service workers and boosting up everyone. That's possible. And, you know, I mean, silly things. I know that my tipping of service workers is way up and it's persistent, you know. And I hear from my friends, everyone just saying, whatever tip, they're underpaid. That's not the solution. They need to be higher paid, but we're going to tip as much as we possibly can. I just think there's an awareness among more educated people, knowledge workers, decent human beings who live in progressive big cities that this has to end. And look, to make a working class that was viable, my dad's working class, we all decided that we'd pay more for cars, you know, and washing machines and television sets. We would pay more for our purchase price so that they can live a good life and have a middle class life. I think we're all now seeing this. And what's interesting about the service workers is in my day-to-day life, I communicate with them. We have Instacart. It's our delivery service in the States. Not only do you chat with them when they're shopping in the supermarket for you, their picture comes up. You see their face. You see who they are. And you're having a real life communication. I can't find the diapers you wanted for your two, but I can find these. I can't find this kind of milk for your four-year-old, but I can find this one. You develop a human bond. And these are simple examples, silly examples. But I think something permanent, you know, and I always say to them, you're my hero. Thank you. It almost brings tears to my eyes when I'm communicating with these people. And they're risking their health and safety for my family. This, I think, is going to permeate. And I do think that so many of us are decent human beings. Some people are less so, but Trump, Lord God. So many people are just saying we have a shared humanity. So, yes, I do think now is the time we could have a growing cross-class awareness. And those of us who choose to live in cities, most of us, tend to be progressive. We tend to be on the left of the political spectrum. We tend to care about women's rights, minority rights. We tend to appreciate a social safety net. We like the fact that people would be covered by healthcare. These things matter to us. Now's the chance to do it. And I think there's a possibility. Now, the question is, that might not go up to the national level. You know, we also have a lot of conservative forces, populistic forces, nationalistic forces. So maybe the new deals, if you will, to use that word, the new deals that we forge tend to be local. There's one in, you know, London. There's one in New York. There's one in California before they become national. But yeah, I hope. Maybe it's the hopeful side of me, the optimistic side of me. But I hope at least we get the glimmers and the beginning of these kind of new deals. I don't mean to be critical here. But I want to say one thing. There's been a lot of attention paid to the Green New Deal and to climate change. And I think for most people, those are far off ideas. They're important ideas, but they're far off. And to be honest, there's been too many celebrities involved. The idea of a healthy and safe and secure and resilient city is very immediate, where my kids and family are safe. So I think if we just recalibrate it. Now, the green idea is a good idea, and we have to be safe from climate change in the long run. But if we had, in the short run, we're going to pay our frontline workers more and make our city safe and healthier. And in the long run, we have to become more resilient. If we had a new deal for health and safety, I just think that resonates a lot. It's not meant to be critical of the other one. It just resonates with people in the here and there.
And I mean, that touches on, I suppose it goes back to what you were saying earlier on, referring to Benjamin Barber's sort of thinking, where part of his thinking is around much stronger city alliances or city networks, where they become, you know, significant players in dealing with issues that, you know, they are experiencing, but also that transcends them, rather than, you know, necessarily always focusing on, you know, the nation or national government. And that's a different thing to responding in the immediate term to the pandemic. But over the longer run, you might see alliances between different cities about how they then get into the recovery and and reopening sort of phases of what you were talking about.
I think we're already seeing that. You know, I mentioned earlier that the fact that these states in America, California, New York, Washington, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, are banding together in a consortium. Ben would have loved this. I think that big cities, you know, his idea of a league of mayors is becoming much more realistic now. And I think it's because nation states are so dysfunctional. And, you know, nations are big places and they have lots of competing interests, business interests, personal interests, conservative and liberal interests. Cities tend to have a more homogeneous makeup, you know, because we vote with our feet. We pick the kind of places we want to live and work. If we want to pay more for transit, if we want to pay more for health and safety, if we want to pay frontline workers more, if we don't want it, well, that's not the case in the UK, but in the United States, we don't want to carry a gun. We go to certain kinds of places and people who don't go to other places. So yeah, I think it's easier to think about these cross-state and cross-city alliances over time, particularly prompted by the fact that national governments, these are going to happen quicker in places like the United States where you have a national government that's either completely dysfunctional or worse, actually working against city interests. So yeah, I think we're likely to see more of that. I think it's still early days. But you can imagine, you know, thinking out from what Ben said, in another couple of decades, given this activation, you could see something like a global league of cities or a global league of subnational governments. Yeah. And I think that's where we have to get. You know, I think we have to get to a place because I just don't think we can solve problems nationally because we're so divided. You know, you think about Brexit, you think about Trump, you think about populism. I think when these issues get pushed up to the national level, they become so highly divisive that you could almost exist better if things were. And in what the studies in the United States are really interesting. They not only took liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, they took the most left and the most right, the most extremely polarized subgroups. On national issues, they couldn't be further apart. On local issues, there was near complete consensus. The only issue in which there was great difference was gun control, which, you know, I understand why. But on almost every other issue that would affect people's day-to-day life that was local, there was near complete consensus. So that tells me something, that if we push a lot of the day-to-day stuff down to local level, and the national government, you know, takes care of defense and maybe, you know, the central banking issues and you know, really fiscal, big fiscal issues like in a recovery. But if most of the disaster response, recovery, economic strategy, economic development is left to the local or state levels, I think we'll be better off.
Yeah, I was told by one U.S. mayor not so long ago when I was chatting to him, he said, in the U.S., we've got three political parties. We've got the Democrats, we've got the Republicans, and then we've got the mayors. And, you know, and his point was the point that you were making, which is when you get into the, you know, at the lower level, actually thinking about what makes cities, places successful, there is an awful lot of consensus, irrespective of your political bias, when you think about, you know, national issues, which gives us great encouragement, I think, for the next phase.
Structural position of mayor that's critical. And I think this is where I was saying it's not just if mayors rule the world, not to be critical of Ben. I think it was a great, you know, in fact, the guy who titled that book was my editor from Rise of the Creative Class. He then went to Yale University Press. The guy has a way, he's just a brilliant, I didn't think of Rise of the Creative Class. I never asked Ben, but this guy has a marvelous way with titles. as soon as I saw If Mayors Rule the World, I'm like, that's Bill. That's Bill.
That's a great title.
Brilliant editor. But I think, you know, the thing I mentioned about Boris Johnson, you can't just put a mayor in a national position. The national position of leadership has a different structure, different constituencies, different constraints. It's the role of mayor. It's the role of city leader. You can take the same person and make, you know, and on the flip side, look at Bernie Sanders. I don't think he would have made the mayor, former mayor of Burlington. He wouldn't have made a fantastic, nice guy, but wouldn't have made a fantastic president. It's really the structural position of local or state leader that makes someone work more effectively. You know, and so I think it's really pushing, it's not simply putting mayor in a position of national leadership. That's the wrong way to think about it. It's taking the functions of national governance and putting more of those, shifting, devolving more of those powers to the local and subnational levels. That's going to make us a more effective and I think a more peaceful and a less polarized society.
Oh, well, it's a fantastic sort of thought. And just to close, Richard, and you've kind of said it, but just to reemphasize, I was asking lots of, you know, colleagues and contacts through Twitter and social media more generally, you know, give me the questions that you want me to put to Richard, and I'll do my best to do it. And we've covered, you know, a great number of them. And I suppose, you know, many of them, not all of them, but many of them touched on this question and issue about, and you've talked about it. I just get to reiterate this point around, you know, whether our cities are over, in a sense. We've gone too far with urbanism over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, and there's, you know, there's due for a recalibration and such. And, you know, your thoughts on that. My paraphrase or thinking about what you've been saying is actually you remain optimistic about the enduring strengths of cities, and pandemics are things that we need to grapple with and tackle and do better about, but they're not the things that will ultimately undermine the very rationale and reason for cities.
No, I think cities and metropolitan areas will remain great. We may see some slight reallocation of families and older people out of the city center, but all of that will be temporary. You know, somewhere down the line, you know, you think about 2008, that was already 12 years ago. 9/11 was nearly two decades ago. We're just going to forget about this. You know, it's going to go away. And we are going to go back to life the way, and we'll have this great unmemory. You know, we'll have this forgetting, which I mentioned earlier in the outset. We forgot about 1918. I was never told that I was born in a pandemic. So cities are always the greater force than infectious disease. They've, you know, throughout time immemorial, urbanization has been the most powerful force. Infectious disease has been a secondary force. You know, I know there's a lot of, we call it Monday morning quarterbacking and criticism and cynicism, and it might be that our two countries have very polarizing leaders in Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, and that those of us on the left want to blame them. But, you know, I don't want to sound like Pollyanna over here. But what if we get out of this with a public health freaking miracle? I mean, this is what, you know, what if it's not millions? What if it's tens of thousands? And you know, I'm not making this comparison in a vulgar way, but 50, 60,000 people in America die of the flu every year. The number right now that's being projected is 60,000. Not, I wish every one of those people were still alive. I wish nobody had to go to the hospital and get this damn thing. But what if it's not millions? And I'll qualify that by saying, I think what I really worry about, what keeps me up at night, is what might happen this summer in the global South. I think what all of us need to remember is if we can have social distancing, if we can have physical distancing, if we can, not only the wealthy, but protect our frontline workers with PPE better, and we will have antiviral. I know already, because I've been hearing from people in hospital, we're already trying antiviral therapy, and some of it, they don't want to say, but some of it looks like it's actually helping, right? It's not solving, but helping. They're going to learn this. And you know, so if two places had to be hit that are going to invent this stuff, London and New York, if you're going to have the scientific community and medical community that can learn how to mitigate this virus and develop the antivirals and learn about it, like Tony Fauci says, we have to learn from the virus. What worries me is not how the global South, the cities of the global South, but I think in the advanced countries, we could have a modern miracle, and we could look back and say the combination of public health, social and physical distancing, rapid mobilization, the creation of these field hospitals, surge capacity. New York never ran out of ventilators. We had the surge capability. We have too many poor people and people with pre-existing conditions, and they succumbed, and not enough good health coverage in the United States. You are much better in England with the NHS, National Health Service. But we could be looking at kind of a miracle in a way, again, not to sound Pollyannish, in the advanced countries. And maybe that's a wake-up call to us that we had to mobilize to do this, that we can do better in the future. And it's not like this is going to be the last virus, you know? How many have we seen? SARS-1, MERS, Ebola, Zika, now this one. You know, it's not like this is the last one. So maybe we'll figure out a way out of this that we make our city stronger. And then hopefully, I think that the bigger question is, how do we as a world now mobilize to take what we've learned and done in the advanced cities, which are going to be fine, in the scope of things, and make sure the mega cities of the global South have some semblance, some similar kind of protection? How do we build a more robust economic infrastructure, public health infrastructure, so that those places can become more resilient in the future?
My guest today has been Richard Florida. Richard, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Thanks for doing all you do, Andrew.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Center for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Center for Cities. Please rate, review, and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Center on Twitter at Center for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Center is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centerforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved.